session.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just didn't want to have too many slides, but just to make the points. But yeah, Peter Kotcher from Holland, is it?
Denmark.
From Denmark.
He's the Cochrane director of Cochrane Collaboration. Cochrane.
So there's so many psychiatrists who are writing against their training. But we have, there's human suffering exists, so how do we address it? Here's a Dutch psychiatrist, Jim van Os, who suggests schizophrenia as a term should be abolished. He says it does not exist. The British psychiatrist, Sir Robin Murray, describes how the term schizophrenia will be confined to history. And we know that there's people have this suffering and symptoms of suffering, and we know childhood trauma is one case, but why medicate? And open dialogue. I'm also a trainer for the last couple of years, and again next month I'm a trainer on open dialogue, bringing in the cultural aspects for NHS staff on different ways of approaching suffering. Last week there was a chain, Making Real Change Happen, an ISPS conference in Liverpool. And again there was an article by Simon Carter-Jones from Trinity College Dublin, writing an article, "The concept of schizophrenia is coming to an end." So the professionals are suggesting it. There is a dilemma, because some people are suggesting it's coming to an end, and other people are practicing it. And I think we need to look at that. Thank you. There's a social media group on Facebook, Drop the Disorder. I think it started about a year ago, and it's got over 5,000 members now. It's people who are suffering but don't want to be called disorder, and people who are clamouring for a different kind of support other than medication when they know they've been traumatised in this life, and nobody wants to discuss their trauma or put them through the counselling. So Drop the Disorder is an interesting group, but there's many others as well. And
a book by Teresa Sund. Her parents were Jewish in Greece and they were taken to Auschwitz, and she helped her mother write the book about her mother's experience in Auschwitz. Okay. Now, because her mother spoke German, she was actually used in the office for administrative purposes, and this saved their lives. And she and her sister both survived and came back. Their father died on the way back in a convoy. And these years later, she works as a colour light therapist, and she helped her mother write a book about the family experience. From her, she put in her childhood, which was a happy one on the waterside in Greece with her Jewish father running a very successful business, and then they were all taken away. And so she's recorded all these memories, and it's had an immensely healing effect on all of her family and many, many friends.
Yeah, because you address it. Later, may I leave my notebook out? So for those of you who've made suggestions, would you just jot them down? And I can send them to everybody, so that we all have those kind of experiences. I've never managed to write my memories down in the same way that Yael Sharp. She just did it. I suppose you write it down and you finish with it. When you don't write it down, then it's harder to integrate it.
It's just noted, so just going back to the drop the language of disorder.
says me.
So I just rearranged it to say, well, should we adopt the Dissel language?
Yes, I think this kind of
yeah, it's called an language.
Yeah, no, but that will come up.
I think we should let that continue because it's already 9:45.
I'm rushed.
No.
It's all right.
We've got it. Yeah.
We'll do it. We like finishing anyway. So this issue around the dilemma around that some practitioners are really aware and educators are carrying on educating the same old stuff. And I have a problem. I've been teaching for 10 years at Brighton and Sussex Medical School in the name of medical anthropology. And I teach 8 sessions, and the one on mental health is the hardest for me because the students have just learned about diseases of the brain, chemical imbalance, the fact that migrants and refugees have a predisposition in their bodies for mental health, completely disregarding the politics, economics around their situation. So the mental health is the most challenging that I teach at Brighton. And there's always this elephant in the room that nobody wants to acknowledge between these experiences and psychosis. I've done the book Cultural Perspectives on mental well-being. The publisher found me. It was very curious. I was at a conference. I wasn't a speaker. I was just in the audience. I was at a conference and I made a comment about the topic was racism and mental health, and nobody was addressing it. And I made a 1 minute. One minute round, and the senior commissioning editor came up to me in the tea break and she said, oh, have you written anything? And then a week later, she was in my front room and I got the contract. And all the way through, when I gave it to the editor, I kept thinking, they're not going to accept this. They're going to come back to me and say, you can't say that sort of thing. And they just sorted out a few commas and full stops and they just left it. As it was, so I mean, I'm deeply grateful. And the publisher's name was Natalie, which is good. But it happened. So people want they want profound change. They want the context of their experience of knowledge. They want poverty and institutional racism addressed. And they want experiences considered a spiritual awakening. All right, thank you. So, I'm just going to spend the next couple of slides looking at silos. Because a silo, it can be a grain storage, it can be an underground chamber to store missiles in, or it can be a system that operates in isolation from others, like these, everybody in its private silo. Okay, thank you. So, the silo mentality, in business, it's a mindset when certain departments or sectors do not wish to share information with others in the same company. That's also a silo. Or an information silo. A management system incapable of reciprocal operation with other related systems. So, and silos have a negative impact on mental well-being, and it discourages groups from sharing information with each other. Okay. And so this is an academic silo. So here we have an academic. And here we have the silo with the hat on. Academic silos are departments that study the same phenomena but refrain from collaboration. And I'm a generalist, I can never claim to be a specialist, and I'm a generalist, so I look across different ways. And the problem with academic silos, there's a problem with psychosis, schizophrenia, visionary experiences, spiritual awakening, religious experience, end-of-life experience, spirit possession, mediumship, shamanic experience, all the... if you have a near-death experience and you're calm, lovely. End-of-life experience and you're calm, fine. Out-of-body experience and you're calm, very nice. If you have those same experiences with distress, there's an assumption that you might have a disease of the brain. And this is what's annoying me about academia. Thank you. Ooh, again. There should be three. So, when I'm looking at expanded consciousness, my opinion is with spontaneous experiences, they're expanded consciousness. You have them and they stop. And they may transform your life, but they stop. For those specialists, like healers, shamans, psychics, clairvoyants, mediums, whatever, they deliberately choose to have an expanded state of consciousness and stop. And then with psychotic experiences, you can have the same range of experiences, but not be able to witness what they are, and you have no on-off switch. Mm. If you have an on-off switch, it's not a mental health problem. If you don't have an on-off switch, people think, oh, it's a disease of the brain. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to me. Okay, thank you. And this material, it's in much more detail in the book, with all the references and full stops and commas and quotes and the like. So, academic boxes, we've got religious experience, the different psychologies, anomalous experiences of near death, out of body, the specialists, we've got anthropology that studies altered states of consciousness, and then we've got psychiatry, and they're all looking at extreme experiences. But if you haven't got distress, you can be studied. If you've got distress, it's a problem. And the current diagnostic and statistical manual for psychiatry has 297 disorders, in case we're wondering where we fit. So I'm sure we could find a place. So for me, academic silos are a real problem. Okay, so it's language, it's the meaning of language, because if somebody says they're having a vision and I believe them, it's a vision. If I don't believe them, it's a hallucination. If they're seeing an apparition and I believe them, it's okay, they're seeing an apparition, as long as they're calm and not in distress. If I don't believe them, they're delusional. And then if more than one person, because there's examples, there's so many examples of people who, groups of people who've seen things that other people can't compute, then we say they're having a mass delusion. And then veridical is their true. So it depends what we believe as to how we diagnose somebody. And clinicians' beliefs are really important. Yale University did a study into people's beliefs about disorders, so-called disorders. And it depended on what the clinician believed, they offered different kinds of treatment. If they thought psychotherapy would be effective, they'd offer that. Or if they thought medication would be suitable, they'd offer that. And if you correlate that with someone's ethnic identity, which I'm not going to do here, you get very interesting results. Thank you. So, we're coming up to the last few slides, you'll be pleased to hear. So there is a problem with hierarchies of knowledge and whose knowledge dominates the status quo. And in the past, Western opinions have dominated cultural wisdoms that came out from Indigenous people, Australians, North Americans, South Americans, Canadian, Inuit. And it is a particular problem for people who have extreme experiences. And there's also this assumption that biomedical models of mental health are universal. Thank you. So, the proposition that I have is that some people with extreme experiences may be having a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience, an end-of-life experience, or remote perception with anxiety and distress. And that, if you have it with anxiety and distress, then we're uncomfortable with you. If you spontaneously have these experiences and don't have a framework for understanding them, or if the people around you, if you're the observers, feel that, so you can be hospitalised. I've done research projects with the Alistair Hardy archive with people's responses to religious experiences. And it depends on the belief of the observer as to whether it's a psychiatric problem or not, which isn't good enough. Okay. So, and the proposition is that there are specialists like shamans, psychics and remote viewers who deliberately invite experiences and can turn them off and on. And my question is it normal for human beings to be porous or to be like radio transmitters and have information coming beyond time and space? And then, if consciousness exists beyond bodily death and other realms can be tuned into, perhaps it's time to reevaluate our own understanding around mental suffering. Okay. And this is key, it's absolutely key. It's for me, it's not enough in this room that there's an awareness. It's time for medical educators to address teaching about extreme experiences. Because we can't have a Natalie type of medical anthropologist going into a medical school and psychiatrists of long-standing coming in the following day or the day before with a completely contrasting view. Somehow we need to raise awareness with the education system to incorporate this new knowledge. And it's also time for politicians to abolish legislation which discriminates against people with mental distress. So the legislators need to be addressed. And it's time for us to shift from control of people with distress to compassionate care. And so my question to everybody is, what practical steps can we take to question the old assumptions around mental health? Is there anything each one of us can do? Is there something that we can do to question the old assumptions and have it outside the academic silo? So thank you.
Thanks so much, Natalie. That's very, very comprehensive. We'll take 5 minutes for questions, so that we'll give each of the first two speakers like 55. John, on Ruth.
Thank you, Natalie. That was a marvellous overview. Yes, I do believe that we are radio transmitters. Obviously, we have to relate to our conscience this morning, but I think that I certainly believe in past lives, and we could well have had, although we can translate, we could well have had past life. I guess that we were born after 1945, so we could be a reincarnation.
I, or whoever I tuned into, died in 1945, and I was born 7 years later.
Yeah. So
and I didn't time. Want to be born.
No.
Thank you. Ruth and Rally.
It's not so much a question as a contribution, which is to draw your attention to the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology. It's a movement that's very strong in the States, and they're really looking at new ways of working on the levels that you're talking about, how to engage the energy body, the energy field, and psychology. And in the UK, Phil Mollen, who's currently chair of ASA, has written about 10 years ago now on psychoanalytic energy and psychology. And he was really taking his explorations now to new levels of sophistication that we'd find really interesting.
No, that sounds really good, because I'm interested in people who